As of September 2015, the annualized total returns for the Global Innovators Funds and MSCI World Index are as follows. For the one-year period, the fund returned negative 7.20% and the index returned negative 4.51%. For the five-year period, the fund returned 13.28% and the index returned 8.99%. For the 10-year period, the fund returned 8.87% and the index returned 5.44%. Since the fund's inception on December 15, 1998, the fund returned 6.43% and the index returned 4.77%. The gross expense ratio for the fund is 1.26%. Performance data quoted represents past performance and does not guarantee future results. The investment return and principal value of an investment will fluctuate so that an investor's shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than their original cost. Current performance of the funds may be lower or higher than the performance quoted. For performance current to the most recent month end, please visit www.gafunds.com. Mutual fund investing involves risk. Principal loss is possible. Distributed by Quasar Distributors, LLC.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Guenis Atkinson Asset Management Q3 2015 conference call and webinar. All participants will be in listen-only mode. After today's presentation, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. If you're at your computer, please submit your questions in the questions chat box located on the bottom of your webinar navigation bar, or you may submit your questions directly to trogers@dakotafunds.com. Please note this event is being recorded. I would now like to turn the conference call over to Mr. Matthew Page and Dr. Ian Mortimer, portfolio managers for Guenis Atkinson Asset Management. Gentlemen, please go ahead.
Thank you, Tracy, and welcome everyone to the call. Very kind of you to join us. Essentially, we are going to do a quick run through of how the fund performed in Q3 and then sort of close up for questions, hopefully in about 20 minutes' time. But what we'd first like to do is if you just move over to the second page, page two, we can just give a quick run through of who's on the call, and then we'll give a couple of minutes just to remind folks about how we actually run the fund. So today, as Tracy mentioned, it's myself and Matthew. We're sort of portfolio managers on the Guenis Global Innovators Fund, and we've been running the fund together now for just over 5 years. Moving on then to page three, just a quick overview of the strategy. Ultimately, you should think of this fund as a global multi-cap growth strategy with a value discipline. And I think the value discipline is quite key, particularly in today's markets, and something we're going to be discussing throughout the call. But ultimately, we are just trying to seek quality growth companies, attractive valuations. We've got a fairly disciplined, systematic approach, and generally have a mid to large cap bias. It's a concentrated portfolio of best ideas, and it requires us, or it means we have a very high active share. We typically have 30 stocks in the portfolio, all of which are equally weighted. We're very much sort of fundamentally driven and buy and hold. So we're very much low turnover. Typical holding period for us is in the range of 3 to 5 years. If we then move on to page four, and we just think quickly about our investment philosophy and what we're trying to achieve. Ultimately, we think that innovative companies, whether that's through their business model or their products, or maybe even through sort of technological advances, have the best chance of continuing or defending a good or high return on capital. And we think that that means they can potentially outperform their peers over the longer term. The way we think about the return on capital is really in two ways. The first is that we do consider more mature businesses, and those are businesses that have this persistently above average return on capital across an entire business cycle. So here we're thinking over at least a 10-year period. And the idea is that it's the sort of good companies stay good, and that these companies that have shown and maintained that persistency of their return on capital must be doing something better than their peers. And our analysis historically has shown that there's a very high probability that these types of businesses continue to do well. The second type of business we look for are those with sort of slightly more less mature, maybe more improving return on capital profile. So these are companies that we believe offer the potential to actually achieve that above average return on capital in the future. But also these companies are potentially have better opportunities for growth in terms of them reinvesting their cash flows in higher and higher return projects. The key thing for us, though, is that not paying up too much for that expected growth. You know, we believe that buying companies at attractive valuations significantly increases the potential to earn higher returns if you can hold that investment over the longer term. It also, we think, provides quite a good sort of margin of safety from a risk perspective to maybe mitigate against unforeseen circumstances that we can't necessarily predict in the marketplace. And I think events over this week, particularly in the biotech space, have shown that to be the case. Lastly, we think our sort of portfolio design will actually add usefully to total return or performance over the longer term. The rebalancing process that we have in terms of sort of selling some of our winners and then maybe putting that money to work in some of those the investments we have that maybe underperformed a little bit, we think can over time add quite meaningfully to performance of the fund. If we then move on to page five, I'll just quickly run you through our investment process. And really it's just to say we take that those sort of innovative companies and those persistently high return on capital businesses. And what we're then trying to do is prioritize them through thinking about their business strengths, thinking about their valuation, and thinking about their growth prospects. And what that allows us to do is narrow down that investable universe to a smaller group where we can sort of focus on our fundamental analysis. We are very much a sort of bottom-up driven strategy. We do not make sort of huge macro calls at the portfolio level. And really, we're trying to analyze those companies that seem to have some characteristics we'd like to see, and then analyze or assess where we think their return potential can come from. That then leads us to do one of three things. It's either reject the idea, because we have then decided that actually it's a fairly weak business or a business that is a quite a poor allocator of capital. We then might think it's actually quite a good company, but we don't like the valuation, in which case it goes on the watch list. Or lastly, you know, we think the combinations really match up and the idea is quite compelling, so therefore we may add it to the portfolio. What we'd really like to see, though, is a sort of 50% upside over a three-year view. And what we'd also like to see is some element of that coming from the multiple re-rating, and that's really our value discipline coming through. If you then move on to page six, we just highlight that combination that we're always looking for. It's that prospect for the high return from cash flow growth. So that's really thinking about that growing return on capital or that the persistency of that return on capital. And the second thing is the prospect for a return from a re-rating. So that's thinking about companies that are slightly out of favor. Maybe the market sentiment is against them. That allows us to get the return from the re-rating. It's that combination of those two things that we are looking for to get our 50% upside to current valuation over a three-year plus period. The key thing to remember is the mix between the business value creation and the return from the re-rating will be different for different companies. If you have a more mature business with slightly lower growth, you may want more of the return from the re-rating. Similarly, if you're in a slightly faster growth company, it's unlikely you're going to get a huge return from re-rating because typically those types of companies are slightly more richly valued. The key thing for us, though, is we want to avoid story stocks and we don't want to be paying up for expected future growth that is unlikely to occur. So with that, I'll move on to page seven, which then looks at the actual performance of the fund versus the benchmark. And you can see in Q3 that the fund has underperformed slightly in what was a very difficult quarter. You know, we saw lots of issues, I think, that are now well known in terms of whether it was something that was going on in China or our worries of just growth generally. I think what we see, though, is that this is something that we would typically expect for this type of strategy. You know, we are generally looking at the, you know, less defensive types of businesses. And I think what was interesting is over the quarter, if we look at the MSCI world, the only two sectors that were left in positive territory over Q3 were the staples sector and the utility sector. These are two sectors that we have no exposure to in the portfolio. And over the life of the fund, which is going back about 12 years, I don't think we've ever owned a utility, and we've maybe only had a very moderate exposure to something like staples. So although it still was disappointing to underperform, I think this is something that we would have expected. And I think what's key for us is that we try to, as we'll mention in the back half of the presentation, is that when you see some of these corrections or drawdowns, it does actually present opportunities for us to then potentially purchase companies that we have liked, maybe they're on our watch list, and actually their valuations have come more into range. So if we move on then to page 8, in terms of some attribution, we've just simply put the top 5 performing stocks in the quarter for the fund against the bottom 5 performing stocks. I think taking the bottom 5 performing stocks to start with, I think the key thing here that's really overlaying it is emerging market exposure and higher beta type stocks. So Lenovo being a more cyclical business, being listed in Hong Kong, and also having you know, a large proportion of their revenue stream coming from that market, it's unsurprising that we've seen that was the worst performing fund, the worst performing stock in the fund. Similarly, things like Applied Materials in terms of exposure to the semiconductor industry, and something like Schlumberger obviously had more of an effect due to the oil price, which is also linked to expectations for future growth. In terms of the top 5 performing stocks, I think it's interesting that, you know, 2 of our companies actually returned over 20% in the quarter, considering, you know, so that's a sort of 30% outperformance versus the benchmark. You know, both of these are really stock specific, you know, just in the very good performance Nvidia, it's a very long-term holding in the fund and continues to have done very well. And H&R Block actually had, you know, sold down or finally got through some of the restructuring that the market had been expecting and got a boost there. If we then move on to page 9, we just put the fund's performance of the quarter into context of the long-term performance of the fund. And I think what's key here is a couple of things. The first thing is, you know, we're still quite pleased with our longer-term performance, but if you look at the 2015 year-to-date number, negative 9.9 for the fund, negative 5.6 for the index, you can put that in context a little bit to the year, the yearly return of 2011 or the yearly return of 2008. That if markets are down, it's typical that this fund underperforms a little bit. What we can say, though, is we can't predict the future, but if we start to see markets rebound, the fund has historically shown a very strong ability to do well in that type of environment. What we'll then do throughout the rest of the presentation is maybe take you through some of the stock changes we've made, and at the end of the presentation we can see what the portfolio looks like today, some of its valuation metrics, and maybe that can give you a bit of an idea for how we think this fund might perform going forward. So with that, if we move on to page 10, I'm going to hand you over to Matthew Page, who will take you through the rest of the presentation.
Yeah, thanks, Ian. So in terms of changes to the portfolio in the quarter, it was a fairly active quarter for us in terms of switches. As you know, our turnover tends to be very low at about 20 to 25% per year. And I think, you know, when you look at the switches that we've made, certainly on the buy side, they tended to be quite opportunistic in response to the volatility we saw through the middle of August. And on the sell side, it was a mixed bag. Some of those companies we were selling at what we perceived to be sort of peak valuations. Others were companies where we became a bit more worried about the long-term prospects for the business, like Xerox and Ultra Electronics. If we go to the next slide, the first stock we sold was TD Ameritrade. And the key reason for this was valuation. We sold this towards the beginning of the quarter in mid-July, and it was trading on a PE, which when we looked at it relative to its 10-year valuation range, was right towards the top. It also became the most expensive stock on our portfolio on a number of valuation metrics, and that is something we pay quite a lot of attention to. You know, we don't like to own companies when they're trading at the top of their valuation ranges, particularly for those more mature businesses where we believe you know, reversion to the mean is a powerful force. If we go to the next slide, we replaced TD Ameritrade with Verifone. And Verifone is the market leader in providing point-of-sale payment technology to retailers. and they're currently benefiting from the rollout of chip and pin or EMV technology in the US. And that's being driven by a shift in liability away from the car providers to the merchants that will come into play as of October this year. So that's quite important for these merchants to get this technology in play. And what's interesting is despite that shift in liability coming in October this year, we only expect the market to be about 40% through that process. And it's really been, you know, the large supermarkets and companies selling, you know, high-priced goods that have been first to move to this technology. Obviously, they're more at risk of this card fraud. Longer term, we're very excited about their prospects in Asia as well. If you go to the next slide, the next stock we sold was Capital One. And again, this was really, again, driven by valuation. Again, when we looked at it relative to its history, you know, a lot of these financial stocks have done particularly well over the last 3 years. Some cases being driven by expected increased interest rate rises on the near horizon. We also, though, observed that you know, Capital One, in their last quarterly earnings report, reported a large reserve buildup, suggesting that growth in their revenues has been driven by potentially, not certainly, but potentially lower quality customers. And on that basis, we felt, given it was trading at a historic high, the risk reward was not sufficiently attractive for us. And then next slide, we you know, we bought Cognizant, and this was one really that had been on our watch list for a while, and we took advantage again of that dip in the market in August to pick it up. It's a classic, consistent high return on capital company that also has very attractive growth. It's done extremely well, you know, making a number of bolt-on acquisitions. So on the next slide, just to summarize, you know, the effect of those changes to the portfolio, there's really three elements to that as far as we're concerned, three elements that we focus on. It improved the growth rate of the portfolio in terms of the growth in earnings and cash flow. Secondly, I think the companies that we are have switched into have improved the quality of the portfolio in terms of the profile of their return on capital. And third, you know, we've taken out some companies that we believe had risk of multiple contraction because they were trading at historic high levels. On the next slide then, we just show you how the portfolio breaks down in terms of our company's long-term growth rates. And I think it's interesting to see that at the moment we've only got one company that we have in that 20% plus growth bucket. And you know, typically that has been a smaller part of our portfolio. Over the last 10 years or so, it's tended to represent between 0 and 20% of the portfolio. And we tend to be quite conservative when we come up with these estimates for long-term growth. You know, potentially PayPal could be in that bucket. Gilead, which is in the 10 to 20% bucket as well, may have been there maybe a couple of years ago. But certainly, you know, we've got the highest weighting we've tended to have in that 10 to 20% growth bucket at the moment. And the key reason behind that really is valuation. You know, a lot of the companies that we observe that are growing at 20% plus are not trading at valuation levels that are attractive to us relative to the sector and relative to the company's own history. You can see the portfolio with a few more metrics on the next slide. And I think the key things to point out here is, you know, as we always try to you know, keep that discipline on valuation, we've got the portfolio trading at a discount to the broad market of about 5%. And at the same time, you know, we are it tending to be slightly more in the larger cap names than maybe we were, say, 5 or 6 years ago, but we've still got about 8 companies, which I would call in the mid-cap range. The effect, if you go to the next slide, 18, on the portfolio in terms of sector and industry breakdown has been to boost our IT exposure a bit more. And indeed, we now have 27% in the software and services industry, which is to the top end of the range that we will allow ourselves to go. We continue to believe that there are high quality, high return on capital companies with good growth prospects over the longer term, in many cases with large cash balances, which is going to allow them to fund that growth going forward and also be friendly with the use of that cash for shareholder returns. In terms of regional breakdown, we're now 75% in the US. That's gone up a little bit, 12% in Asia and 10% in Europe. So in terms of a bit of an outlook, I mean, one of the things that Ian touched on earlier, if we go to the next slide, was just, you know, considering how value and growth have interestingly deviated substantially this year. If you looked at the MSCI World Value and MSCI World Growth indices over the last, say, 3 or 4 years, they've really traded pretty much in lockstep without any great deviation. Whereas this year, we've seen growth outperform value quite substantially. You know, by the middle of September, there was a 7% difference. However, we did then see that shift back in the last couple of weeks of the month, and potentially we are at an inflection point there. And if we go to the next slide, I think you know, the point we're trying to make here again is that, you know, when we look for new stocks and when we consider our portfolio, we're always expecting some element of the total return to come from value. You know, we are not people that are going to buy a stock trading on, you know, 30, 40, 50 times earnings, which has very exciting growth prospects in the market. We're very cautious about those types of companies. I think there's a lot of evidence that shows that over our time horizon, which is typically a 3 to 5 year holding period, you know, that growth tends to disappoint in aggregate. There are obviously exceptions to that, and those are the stocks we all remember, but there are as many that I think we forget about. On the next slide, we just, you know, note and would like to point out that an example of this, which we think has been the hype in 3D printing stocks. We have not owned any of these. You know, we believe that 3D printing technology is incredibly exciting, and, you know, it is an industry that can grow, you know, at potentially 15-20% per year for quite some time. However, we believe the talk of decentralized, you know, industrial revolution with production coming away from emerging markets and back to Western markets is quite premature. You know, 3D printing is not a new technology either. I think if you read a lot of the media narrative around these companies, you think it was, you know, really quite a new and emerging technology. It isn't. It's been around since the 1980s. And in our view, you know, the key application for this technology, you know, is going to remain in niche, low volume, precision items where cost is not an important factor. These, you know, 3D printing cannot compete with standard industrial production processes. Therefore, you know, prototyping continues to be a strong market for 3D printing. Similarly, we're seeing, you know, Boeing and Airbus use more and more of these 3D printing technologies to make a number of their components. So on the next slide, you can just see that, you know, the share prices of two of the main stocks that exist in this space. There aren't that many. 3D Systems and Stratasys, and I think it just shows you quite interestingly, you know, how a hype cycle can affect a stock both on the way up and then as maybe expectations start to become more realistic and in many cases disappoint. You know, at the peak of these companies' price points, you know, they were trading on multiples maybe of 100 times earnings. You know, the growth expectations at that point were so high that, you know, we really didn't believe statistically that they were likely to come through. However, when hype cycles end, if the companies and the industries are good, there are potentially attractive entry points. So we want to be aware of these types of things. We want to track them. However, we don't think we're quite there yet. So, as a conclusion on the next slide, you know, I think we'd say the portfolio has performed, you know, very much as we would expect it to during quite a volatile quarter with a sharp decline in markets in the middle of August. We like to try and take advantage of that. That's why we've seen more changes in the portfolio this quarter than we have done on average historically. We managed to make a number of changes to the portfolio that we've been monitoring for a while but weren't quite there on valuation. And I think we've improved the quality and the growth profile of the portfolio. I think just to reiterate that, you know, we believe for most of this year, you know, the market has been favoring companies with, you know, growth irrespective of the quality of that growth and irrespective of the value attached to that growth. Potentially, that is now starting to change. So if we move to the next slide, we can then open it up to questions.
Great. Ian and Matt, thank you so much for all of your comments this afternoon. I would just now like to open the call up for Q&A. As a reminder for the audience, if you're at your computer, please feel free to submit your questions via the webinar, or you may submit them to trogers@dakotafonts.com. And first question for you, can you talk about how you're overweight to the U.S. and why? How does that compare to historical exposure over time?
Sure. The you know, all our geographic and sector exposures are really a consequence of our bottom-up investment process. You know, we're not trying to take big macro calls. We don't try and steer our portfolio into you know, economic factors, if you like, or try and get exposure to certain economic beaters. So really, it's where we're finding the best blend of quality, value, and growth. You know, we do have a number of companies which we like that are on our watch list you know, in Europe and in Asia, and you know, we will continue to track those companies. But ultimately, what's going to drive us is that combination of factors. This exposure we have to the U.S. is about as high as we've ever had it in the last 12 years, which is quite interesting in the context of obviously you know, Asia and potentially Europe in some parts looking optically quite cheap. However, we think that is quite skewed by you know, a number of sectors which we are not particularly attracted to, be that banks, you know, be that particularly Asian banks that don't really meet any of our criteria. So we like to be aware of where our geographic exposure is, but it's ultimately a bottom-up consequence.
Great. Thank you, Matt. Next question. With the changes in the portfolio, do you anticipate a larger than usual distribution this year?
I don't believe so. I think it's something we obviously you know, look to manage actively in the portfolio where we can. I think some of the holdings have been long-term holdings, so we'll have to see how that looks versus where we are. But I don't think it's going to drastically change where we are. And we have seen, you know, some sort of loss harvesting, I suppose, in terms of Ultra Electronics, for example, or Xerox, were two businesses that actually we maybe sold because, you know, particularly in the sense of Xerox, it was more of a, you know, we entered the position, it did not do as well or as we expected. The business deteriorated more significantly, and therefore we exited. So therefore, you know, we see that we can sort of manage that, and we wouldn't today expect any changes in the distribution there.
Great. Thank you, Ian. Next question. And you did touch on this kind of in your response to the first question, but what name are you most excited about in the portfolio, and which one are you watching the closest?
Well, I think it's a funny one because we, you know, ultimately we don't really think of the portfolio like that. I mean, one of the things we do in terms of the how we look at the portfolio is it's on an equally weighted basis. So, you know, we don't have our sort of most high conviction sort of stock at 10% of the portfolio, whatever it might be, and our least conviction stock or highest risk at sort of 0.5% of the portfolio. So that's not something we kind of probably would struggle to see. Because I think one of the things we kind of recognize is that, you know, you can, there's quite a lot of biases, behavioral biases, particularly in sort of being a mutual fund manager. And we're trying to avoid them as much as possible. And I think one of those is the idea that, you know, your ability to predict what will happen in the future. And I think for us it's quite hard to sort of necessarily pick out one specific name and say that will do better over a X period by X amount than the next company. I think the one thing I would say, though, in terms of the opposite, though, would be certainly something like, maybe something like a Schlumberger, whereby we have seen a marked change in the environment, particularly with the oil prices doing and CapEx cuts, that has changed dramatically from when we entered the position. So I think that's the type of thing where we would be thinking or be more worried, is probably the wrong word, but more conscious of our holdings if something in the sort of macro environment has changed that affects an individual company. So I think something like Schlumberger is probably the one that would be the most obvious in that sense.
Great, thank you, Ian. Next question, when do you rebalance and how often? Would you add a little more to a name that has not worked and take away from names that have run up in terms of valuation?
Yeah, so the way we rebalance the portfolio is on an opportunistic basis. We don't we try to avoid churning the portfolio or creating trades and trading costs unnecessarily. So we're really quite happy to let our positions move around their modeled weight of about 3.3%, and really only step in if we need to. Often what we'll do is when new money comes into the fund, we'll use that to increase the weights of positions that are a bit underweight rather than create trading costs of selling down some of those positions that are overweight. And essentially, what we really like about this discipline is that, if we did see a company that was having some difficulties and seeing that weight of that position come down, we really need to review, do we still want to continue to own this stock? And it's a great discipline because it forces you to either sell the entire position or add some more to that. And that's, we like that binary outcome, the way that forces you to really consider whether you want to continue to own this company going forward.
Great. Thank you, Matt. And that does look like it concludes our Q&A session for this afternoon. I'd just like to turn it back over to the two of you for any closing remarks today.
Well, just from the both of us, we'd just like to thank everyone who's joined. It's always a pleasure speaking to you. Hopefully we can speak to you more in the future. So with that, I'll say thank you very much and have a great day.
Thank you again to Ian and Matt for your time this afternoon, and thank you to our audience for their participation. I will now read through some required disclosures. Mutual fund investing involves risk and loss of principal as possible. Investments in foreign securities involve greater volatility, political, economic, and currency risks, and differences in accounting methods. These risks are greater for emerging market countries. The fund also invests in smaller companies, which will involve additional risks, such as limited liquidity and greater volatility. The fund may invest in derivatives, which involves risks different from, and in certain cases, greater than the risks presented by traditional investments. Fund holdings and or sector allocations are subject to change at any time and are not recommendations to buy or sell any security. The fund is distributed by Quasar Distributors, LLC. The conference is now concluded. Thank you again for attending today's presentation, and you may now disconnect.